Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hey folks, it's Unsung. It's part four of our REM. We've done it all. We've done it all.
Saga?
Yeah, it's a saga. Yeah, it's a saga. The REM saga is complete today, where we talk about new adventures in hi-fi.
Yeah.
So the last three episodes, we've talked about everything else REM's ever done. So if you're coming in at this point, then
you need some context. Yeah. What the fuck's wrong with you?
Or not, maybe just like this record and you're like, this is all I need.
That's a very erratic podcast approach that you're doing there. Is this your first time?
No, but like, it's like, maybe like, I know the band and I only like one album and this is the album. So I'm just going to go straight to that episode, maybe.
Do you think we should have done this in a big 4-hour Joe Rogan special?
Jogan? Roe Jogan? No, only he can get away with that.
He doesn't get away with it.
Yeah, nobody listens to a 4-hour podcast and a 4-hour sitting, you know.
Some people do. I mean, I have to admit, I did listen to the Alex Jones Joe Rogan episode with my fucking jaw hanging on like for 4 fucking hours. Like, I felt I had a responsibility to do it. Anyway, that to one side, we are going to talk about New Adventures in Hi-Fi from 1996. Which I've chosen as REM's unsung album. I do just want to reiterate that Reveal gets a very, very bad rap. I don't think Reveal is REM's finest moment. I think they were a little bit over the hill. Sorry to be ageist, but they were recording in stodgy ways and a little bit confused about, you know, what kind of band are we? They went back to guitars with Accelerate, but I think Reveal proportionally probably gets more abuse and is in the balance of how good is this album compared to how much shit does it take. It's probably actually the most unsung. Mm-hmm. But I'm not about to go to bat for fucking Reveal because it's Reveal. I am going to go to bat for New Adventures in Hi-Fi, which sits sort of, I wouldn't even say mid-table, because as I've discovered, it sits kind of like upper table. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know, 2024 West Ham.
Yeah.
it's there. It's like, I don't know, 2019 Everton. I fucking don't know.
It's going to get a Champions League place.
Yeah, I fucking hate the EPL. Yeah. So, but it's one of those albums that's in or about the money. You know, it's in or about the prizes, mm-hmm. but it's not that often getting the prizes.
It might not get bronze, but it'll definitely get a participation medal.
Aye. It'll get picked up by a better agent. But it's not Automatic for the People, certainly. It's not Murmur, I guess, which I saw topping a couple of lists by pure fucking hipsters. It's not Out of Time, which was just a massive breakthrough commercial success. It's not Monster, which, I mean, I know you're not keen on it, but I think it's a fucking excellent album. Yeah, it is New Adventures in Hi-Fi, and it's a fucking strange fish. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about it a wee bit.
Okay.
Michael Stipe's favourite REM record.
Yeah.
There you go. That's high praise to start with.
It leans very nicely into his voice and the country feel of what he often does, I think.
Yeah, plus, spoiler here, a lot of this album was recorded live, either in soundcheck or during actual shows. And I think, from experience, maybe you're the same, when you're recording a song, you tend, no matter how good the song is, to be influenced by the experience of the recording. And if you have a particularly arduous experience or exhausting experience with a song, it puts you off it as a musician. The thing is, with this album, Michael Stipe did not have to labour and over take after take after take in a studio trying to get a line, trying to redo a line, trying to change a line. These were live records.
Was there overdubs?
There are overdubs, yeah, absolutely. Mm. But the thing is, once you've got that master take to tape, you're like, oh, thank fuck. And I think for him, this would have still sounded fresh. Michael Stipe could have gone back to this record and listened to it, and it would have still felt urgent. It wouldn't have felt overworked. There wouldn't be bits in it where he was like, oh, fuck. Well, there might be, but the fact is, he wasn't saying fuck because he spent 10 hours in the studio and was just totally burnt out and had to go home. It was just a live take. And they're very good live takes. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you hear it, you're like, fucking hell, this is effectively half of this is a live album. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. So I think that probably colours his perspective on it. And I suspect that that's more true of vocalists anyway, because vocals are such a fucking frustrating thing to try and get right. You know, they really are. Everything's a frustrating thing to try and get right, but vocals in particular are a really annoying thing to try and nail. Mm-hmm. And if you're fighting against the song, you never fucking want to hear it again, you know?
Yeah.
So this was the last album with Bill Berry, as we mentioned, founder member of the band, end of an era. R.E.M. actually, on the back of this, re-signed with Warner for a reputed $80 million. Mm-hmm. Although the band have said that that figure was basically fabricated by the media. Mm-hmm. But it was a lot of money anyway. An interesting quote that I found about this album was in Discover Music, and it says, arguably less immediate and less accessible, New Adventures in Hi-Fi is a sprawling white album-esque affair clocking in at 65 minutes. However, while it acquired some time and commitment from the listener, the record's contents were rich, compelling, and frequently stunning. Now, you're a Beatles fan. I'm not really a big Beatles fan. Mm. I don't hate them, but I'm not a fan. How do you feel about the comparison to the white album?
I think the white album... It's quite sprawling. It's also quite inconsistent. I don't think I'd compare that to this.
No. See, I brought this to the table, but I actually have to say that revisiting this, it's more inconsistent than I remember. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to be really honest about this. As I said,
the White Album's definitely inconsistent, though. It's like four different songwriters doing their own thing.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right. True. Mm-hmm. That's true. Aye. The recording approach to this was very unorthodox. So R.E.M. were on tour for Monster, and they decided, partly inspired by Radiohead, I think, at one point, to take 8 tracks and do recordings as often as they could of the things they were doing at soundcheck and backstage and just demoing things, and actually write a record during the process of touring. The Monster tour, we should bear in mind, was the first tour they'd done since Green. So they'd been away from touring for a long time. So touring again was novel to them, and they wanted to capture that. So they wrote a lot of these things on the road, and it really has a kind of road movie quality to it. The photography for the album, for example, is very significant. The cover art of the album is very significant. The length of the album, I think, reflects the sprawling nature of a tour to some extent. But yeah, like, so you'll find there's tracks on this. We'll mention it when we talk about the song, but there's tracks that were done during the sound checks. There was tracks that are just takes live with the audience there. I think there's one track from backstage, and then there was 4 that were done at Bad Animals Studios in Seattle, you know, I think for singles, really, to try and get them like properly hi-fi. Wikipedia had a quote in it that said, fans generally regard it as the band's last great record before a perceived artistic decline during the late 90s and early 2000s. Now, we covered that in the last episode.
I mean, on balance, that's true.
Yeah, it's probably true. As we said, it's, you know, maybe a little bit cruel at points, but yeah, maybe overall. Lots of retrospectives have reappraised this album as one of their best. It's acquired a little bit of a cult following, which I think is quite nice. I am going to do a low-key flex, and we're going to do this in real time. Mark, I own the special edition of this album. Check it out.
Was this released at the time?
Oh, Jesus.
I'll include that bump in the mix.
This is not the 25th anniversary release.
No, this is the contemporaneous special edition cool. CD box thing. So if you slide that out, it's got a really cute kind of diamond thing. It's very like reclaimed cardboard.
How'd
with
you
like
slide
a,
it out?
It's, you slide it out at the bottom. Yeah, there you go. Gravity will do the rest. And so it's got like a screen printed cover. And then it's really tactile, hardcover book, like kind of fawn coloured book. It sort of reminds me of like an Edward Gorey book or something like that. Like,
but cool.
It's full of the photography from that tour.
Uh-huh.
And it really, like, if you're in a band, it does beautiful justice to that weird intimacy of being in a band backstage, out the window of a bus, cool shit you're going by, the kind of blurred motion pictures of roads and people. And it's a really, really interesting edition of the album. And I think it's like especially interesting because that travelogue aspect of the album is so intertwined with what it is, with the way it was recorded, with the subject of the songs, with the sound of the songs. I just think it's a really interesting aesthetic project that came together really, really nicely.
It is, it's really cool.
Yeah. So it was released on cassette as well, which I don't have, but on the cassette and not on the vinyl. It was a double vinyl, not on the vinyl, but on the cassette, for some reason, they decided to call it the high side and the fi side.
Mm-hmm.
So New Adventures in Hi-Fi had like a high cassette and a fi cassette, and the tracks were split based on that as well. The high side, track by track, shall we? First tune, How the West Was Won and Where It Got Us. Recorded the Bad Animal Studios in Seattle because they wanted to kick off with something a wee bit more pristine. A weirdly languid and beautifully understated song has a vocal thing in it that Michael Stipe went for, where he just kind of goes, and it's such a strange musical decision, but has become like iconic for fans of the band. Like, it's great, it works really well. It's just very fucking odd. The tune itself, the verses and things in particular, showcase how good his voice was at a lower range. Because I think Michael Stipe is sort of
he's a baritone singer.
Exactly. But the lower he goes, he's got such a warmth, like so much personality in his voice at that range. It also, the really sparse piano in it, I think, somehow conjures images of the West.
Yeah, it's a bit, I've written here, it's moody Americana. It's got a strange synth in it in places, but the bass kind of mooches around in the backdrop. It's got some oddly chromatic piano passages. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite understated, and it's got nice backing vocals in the chorus too. It does conjure, a lot of this record conjures up the idea of the West and the desert and, you know, the travel through the country, you know.
When you hear How the West Was Won and Where It Got Us and you think about Murmur era REM, what fucking journey the band's been on, even just to this point, is so different. The second track in it, The Wake Up Bomb, is literally like a wake up bomb. I look good in the glass pack. Okay, the album's going to get going now, and it bursts in. Recorded live in South Carolina during a show. Big, fuzzy, energetic alt-rock. Probably quite consistent with Monster. You know, they were touring Monster at the time. If maybe even a wee bit fluffier than Monster.
The T-Rex are explicitly referenced in the lyrics to this song.
Yeah, it does. It has a lot of T-Rex in it. That kind of glam thing that was in Monster is here. But I think this is almost a little bit more major key.
It's like The Who.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's not a bad example. Aye, aye. Third one, New Test Leper. I can't say that I love Jesus. That would recorded at Bad Animals in Seattle again. I think one of the highlights musically, when I'd said to people that we were doing this album, they singled that song out.
Mm-hmm. Or Waltz Time 3-4. Yeah, it's a cool song. It's got back to that kind of country Americana vibe. Got some of the Django from the first few records mm-hmm. and the arrangement.
It does, yeah.
I've written it's kind of REM by the numbers in places, which is fine, you know. It doesn't feel as hollow as some of the stuff they did afterwards,
yeah.
Where it's very much paint by the numbers, like, you know, and Around the Sun, when they do an REM thing, they're doing an REM thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I really like the narrative arc in it. Mm-hmm. I think I can only assume that they were going through the Bible Belt. There's a lot of like references to I Love Jesus and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's got like a progression through a little story, just a snapshot. It's not really got a beginning and an end, but it has got a journey and there's something really nice about it. Mm. It really draws you in. The track Undertow, recorded live in Boston during the show, has a really desert rock fuzz quality to it. And loads of really interesting guitar stuff in this. Like Peter Buck is living his best self here, like he's having fun. I know what I want to. I know what I want to. Yeah, it's very, very interesting. See, if you listen in headphones, you hear all these little palm mutes and all these little effects that he's doing using the amp and squeals and, yeah, very, very interesting arrangement.
Lumbering bass tone reminds me of Nirvana.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and the middle eight has kind of got that feel to it as well. I think sometimes on this record, it becomes quite clear that Kurt was definitely influenced by Michael Stipe's voice.
Mm-hmm.
It's just some of the phrasings, you know, and some of the... When he's doing his much more melodic stuff, when Kurt was doing the more melodic stuff, you can hear some of Michael Stipe coming in, which is quite interesting. But yeah, it's a good song. It's probably a bit too long for me. Just doesn't need that third verse, you know.
I would agree. It is a little bit long. However, I think Mike Mills needs some credit on this song because his backing vocal is what makes that chorus. And it's actually really quite high up, his counter melody in the background, and it really keeps it alive. The fifth track, Ebo the Letter. Recorded at Bad Animals again in Seattle. It was going to be a single. One of the greatest songs of my teenage years. It really is one of the...
It's a class song.
Yeah. I absolutely love it. It features Patti Smith.
Yep. Tastes like fear.
I think it was everything the record label did not expect. Even the video, the way they did the video, it's like them kind of backlit by these kind of green twinkly lights. It's very, very understated. Patti Smith, I think, is getting on a bus in the video, and it was not particularly MTV friendly. And MTV did try and run with it because people were really into it.
Mm-hmm.
But it just was so antithetical to what they were trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, like fucking, I don't know what was 1996, it wasn't like Alien Ant Farm, but if you can imagine the kind of stuff that was kicking around in 1996, they were like, oh, come on.
Mm-hmm. Fall, eat it, drink, just another chain, cuts and tints, they catch the light, aluminum, make a sling.
I don't want to disappoint you. I fucking love this song. I mean, I mentioned all the personal significance this album has, the train journey, the first girlfriend, the first breakup, all that nervous teenage energy and the song is everything. It's all of that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some beautiful lyrics in it as well. Like, even, I mean, the way it starts, look up, what do you see? All of you and all of me, fluorescent and starry, some of them they surprise. And he's so, it could have been so clunky. It's hard to even say.
Mm-hmm.
And it just flows so beautifully. It's not that rapid fire thing that he does on like End of the World as We Know It. It's almost spoken word. It's almost Enablers, but yet it's musical at the same time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's like honestly, I think this song's a work of art.
It's a really nice laid back song. It's got big alt country vibes for me.
Use of the Ebo.
The
as
Ebo
well.
Feels like a cello when it comes in, which is a really nice touch. Yeah.
First and starry, some of them they surprise.
Yeah, and the organ is lovely too.
Hey, here's the thing, Colin, thank you for all your contributions to this episode and helping us with the facts. Mm. But Colin, aside from buying waistcoats and floral cuffed blouses to look like Peter Buck, also went straight out and bought an Ebo.
Yeah, an Ebo is a cool thing. They're loud as hell though, man.
Yeah, hard to control.
Yeah, they do it really well on this. But yeah, I like Patti Smith's backing vocal as well.
Yeah, it's great.
It adds a lot to it.
What a fucking voice, man.
Yeah.
Honestly, just that right age where she had that kind of Tom Waits character coming through.
Yeah.
The sixth track, Leave.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Very long song.
Mm-hmm.
Very long song.
It's very mournful as well.
I fucking love this song. Mm-hmm. It takes its time to get going as well. Recorded during a sound check in Atlanta, Georgia. It was actually overdubbed afterwards, and I think it's Bill Berry that plays the acoustic guitar in it,
mm-hmm.
in the overdubs. Basically a car alarm motif.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty out there for a band like R.E.M. Basically like a loop pedal
mm-hmm.
and a car alarm motif, like just woo, woo, mm-hmm. woo, like really odd. But I found this song incredibly inspiring. And see, when I was younger and I was trying to write music, I was chasing all these kind of melodic lines, thinking, oh, this melodic line needs to change, that needs to keep the song moving. And actually what this song showed you is that you can have a very simple melody, in this case basically 1.5 notes, and just change the roots underneath it. And the root changes do a lot of the work to change your perspective on that melody. Mm-hmm. And so that car alarm going all the way through this song, while all those beautiful melancholy root note changes take place, and it gives it all of that personality. I really like it. It's mm-hmm. it's a bold statement, but I think they pulled it off really, really well.
I like the guitar tones on it. They're really big and clangy, you know, quite alt-rocky.
Yeah.
The siren gives it a kind of hypnotic feel.
It does.
You know,
Michael Stipe's vocal in it is very like maximalist as well. He's like, he sounds quite pained.
Yeah. That's what keeps me. That's what keeps me. That's what keeps me down. Leave it. Is it a female backing vocal in the mix as well in places?
I'm not sure. See, the thing is though, sometimes Mike Mills, when he does his backing vocal,
it's quite high,
gets to those ranges. Yeah.
It's got a nice touch anyway.
So what would be the Fi side if you had the cassette, which not many of us do? Track 7, Departure, recorded live in Michigan. Just arrived, Singapore, stands fast in Spain, 26 hour trip, Salt Lake City, come in, spring over the salt flats of hailstone, brought you back to me. I really like the song. It's a very direct song for REM. It's kind of like snapping things back into like immediacy if you were not too keen on Leave. It's really nice how the accent on that first riff, like, so the riff starts in with no accompaniment and you're mentally sort of place the accent somewhere, but then when the drums in, come in, it offsets where you kind of tended to think the accent was. I like getting messed with in that way. Michael Stipe does that scatty rapid fire vocal thing that kind of, I know you're not a big fan of
it. I don't like it, yeah.
But I think Mike Mills kind of makes this tune again with the backing vocals. I think they give it the majority of the movement.
Yeah, the chorus and bass, his bass tone as well, like, is mighty on this song. It's brilliant, which really carries this song for me. The vocals are a turn off in the verses, but the good ending as well.
The vocals might be a turn off stylistically. In terms of their subject matter, it sort of conveys the flurry of activity, almost like a time lapse of going on tour. You know, it's like 6 o'clock, blah, blah, blah. And it's about like getting up, getting on tour, get to this, get to the plane, get to the train station, get to that. There's like a functionality to the style of those vocals, though, that is sort of representative of the subject matter as well. Departure, obviously. Yeah. Bittersweet Me, the eighth track. Recorded during a sound check in Memphis, Tennessee. I think actually the song sounds dead weedy until the choruses come
in. Yeah, that's what I said, it brings it to life.
Yeah, the choruses really like kick the song up a bit. Verse is kind of light on the hookiness. I think it's actually the pre-chorus in this that probably has all the beautiful writing in it. I will say though that this is what I was hinting at prior, going back to this record, actually songs like this, I realised I don't like them as much as I used to.
Yes, it doesn't have the staying power of some of the other songs on the record for sure. The chorus is fun, mid-late is also fun. His voice sounds kind of weathered, which I quite like the tone of it in this song. But yeah, it's even got an unresolved ending, which I'm usually a fan of, but it doesn't quite hit right for me in this song.
Yeah, so I mean, out the back of Bittersweet Me, we go into Be Mine. Again, recorded at Bad Animals in Seattle. Another track that features an Ebo. There's a lovely little Ebo solo in it. I think it's an adorable wee song, pretty understated. It's one of those little whispered pines that Michael Stipe seems to love. You know, the very intimate songs where it's almost like they're right up close and just very, very gentle and soft, and you get that ASMR feel to it. It does, admittedly, blossom as the song goes on, and the ending is basically this big, cheerful, lovey, fluffy kind of instrumental.
In the second verse, there's a kind of a low bass tone, which is a bit like a drone, which kind of comes in, kind of like goes, kind of waves in and out, which is a really interesting way of changing up the structure, because it's basically the same structure for both the verses, which I quite like. And that Ebo thing is brilliant. I really like that part. The song does kind of bloom towards the end, which is nice.
I mean, it's a bit saccharine, but it's nice. Binky the Doormat, the 10th one, recorded live in Phoenix, Arizona. I mean, it's all right, this tune. The changes between the verse and the chorus are kind of reminiscent of some of the older stuff. And I think Mike's No Way refrain, you're right, that also kind of takes me back to their early years, a little bit punky and a little bit pointed.
Have you lost? You play. No way. No way. No way. I won't my door.
It's fine as a song.
Yeah, I've kind of said here that the song feels a little bit redundant, to be honest. They've shown me all these tricks before, yeah, and probably better on other records.
And I think given the length of this album, this is one of those ones where you're like, if you were going to be starting to chop stuff out, which this could probably accommodate, that would be one of the ones.
For sure.
Zither, the 11th one, I mean, it's designed to be throwaway. Could you cut it out? Yes, obviously you could, because the whole point is it's just a little palate cleanser. It was recorded in a dressing room actually in Philadelphia. It's cheerful, it's harmless, it's got a lovely wee vibrato over it, but it's really just designed to give you a sort of pause for thought, I think. Yeah. You're not meant to engage with it too much.
I said, I've written, it feels like a slow day in a one horse town sort of tune.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
It does. It's like it's warm outside. You've kind of got your hat over your eyes. You're leaning back in a chair and like a dog goes by on a bike.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
But you're too stoned to do anything about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it comes straight out of that wee mellow guy into So Far So Numb. Which is just an out-and-out alternative rock song. They've really embraced the simple sort of four-chord alt-rock, Smashing Pumpkins, Nirvana, whatever. Recorded during soundcheck in Orlando, Florida. I think it actually feels really of akin with the Monster material that they would have been touring at the time. It's one of their most concise and strong tunes in some years, I think, just in terms of being very lean, and also one that I think it got some of the most play from me at the time, you know, putting it on mixtapes, putting it on mixtapes were playlists, do you know what I mean? It's a really good direct tune for somebody that was just lapping up alt-rock stuff with a nice hook.
Yes, it feels like early REM, but they've got some keyboards in it. There's an organ buried in the mix and the verses. There's actually honky-tonk piano in the chorus, which is obviously something they're bringing in later on in their career. And there's some really nice backing vocals that are buried quite low in the mix as well.
They're good,
which work. And the guitar solo is really fuzzy as well, which I quite liked.
The 13th one, Low Desert, which is only actually 3.5 minutes, which surprised me because it feels a lot fucking longer. Happened fast, it's over quick. A little dust in the engine caps. Recorded during the soundcheck in Atlanta, Georgia, the same time as they did Leave. It's seen by some people, I noticed this online, as a bit of a filler track. It has grown on me a bit over the years. Could it still be cut? Probably. But it's definitely a genre tune, and I think that's quite interesting because it feels stonery, it feels subdued, it feels like the heat of the desert is preventing you from getting too animated. And it cements, I think, that transitory road movie type thing going across those baked, long straight roads, you know, through dusty nowhere. And, you know, it's something that the artwork tries to capture. And actually, to be honest, no song fits more with the artwork for me than this tune, as much as I don't think it's a highlight on the record. Is it musically indispensable? No, but I think thematically it really ties the album together very, very well.
It's very alt country. It reminds me of Wilco quite a lot in places, just because it's got electric guitars and,
you know, I think there's a lot of crossover with that with Wilco as well, and a lot of like old school REM fans graduated to Wilco.
That makes sense. The organ in the chorus is a lovely touch. It's got a cool riff as well that's going on there. I think there's a lot of nice sounds in this song. You know, really well chosen sounds. But yeah, I like the solo actually. It's got a chorus or a phaser. I'm not entirely sure which one it is. Could be both, I guess, at the same time. But I like that too. But yeah, it definitely has a electric country vibe to it for me.
And then they finish with Electrolyte, which
is quite a well-known song for them, yeah.
Electrolyte. I think it's affectionately held in high regard. Mm-hmm. I don't think it wasn't a single. Mm-hmm. I mean, I am really pleased that they finished the record with this song. It was recorded in Phoenix, Arizona, the same day as they did Binky the Doormat. It's a much better song. 20th century a properly good natured, joyous little sign off. You are the star tonight, sun electric out of sight. The light eclipses the moon tonight. Electrolyte. It reminds me of other albums that have signed off with like really sweet sentiments, maybe like All Apologies and In Utero, or like Plenty for All on Audit in Progress by Hot Snakes. Like very upbeat and positive. The band decides, rather than to traumatise you with their final act, like something like, I don't know, Third Eye or whatever, and like by an Onima by Tool, you know, they kiss you on the forehead goodbye in a sweet fashion with this kind of song, and it's very, very nice, and I really like that, and it still sounds good to this day.
It's got a similar kind of vibe to Low Desert, but the chord structure I find a lot more pleasing on this song. The mix of acoustic guitar and the piano is lovely. The fiddle is great when it comes in. There's some really subtle banjo work just plonking away at the deep in the left channel, which is barely even there, but it does add a texture to it. I think there's also a mandolin on it too.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, and the second chorus with electric guitar is a lot of fun too. Just a little touch.
You know, cool. I can't actually believe we got to this point of a four episode REM show and didn't mention the Jayhawks, the American band, because I think there's a lot of their crossover country indie that comes to play with REM, and they were peers as well. But yeah, I mean, I love the kind of countryish, pleasant nature, and the fiddle coming in just really underlines that.
Definitely.
And yeah, it's great. I mean, my final thoughts on this album, being completely fucking honest, I'm the one that's trying to make the case for it, and I have to say, it hasn't actually fared as well as I thought it might have over the years. It definitely deserves respect for innovation in terms of how they wrote and captured it. It's a band trying to instill energy into their work and I think avoid the stale atmosphere of the studio. It definitely to me doesn't sound like it had any real commercial aspirations, and again, that is all going into my, you know, evidence of why REM are not in with those Coldplay or U2s. They were not trying to be this multi-million selling band. They were writing great music, no question. They were writing singles, no question. But they were not doing the things that the 10-step plan to be successful. They were doing shit like this at the height of their fucking fame. It's really odd. So I think I would be satisfied even if we don't end up agreeing on whether or not they are particularly good to listen to. I would hope we could at least agree to extricate them from that mulch of like garbage normie rock that they so often get lumped in with. That to me would represent a victory in this case.
I think in the first episode you said there's a generational thing, an age thing. I think there is. Like you're probably just at the end of the people that would actually listen to this, you know, given when you first started listening to them. I don't know anybody that likes REM at all.
Well, I mean, I know quite a few. I mean, Vicky's an REM fan.
Nobody that I know even talks or thinks about REM. Even
Ferrucci was a big fan of the early stuff, at least, yeah.
Because they're just by the time they come around to the attention of people like me, it was like Reveal era, so they were gone.
Yeah, right. That's true.
They were totally gone.
Totally irrelevant.
Yeah, completely. And because, coming back to what I said at the start, and again, in the second episode, because the trajectory of rock music changed, there was just never any way that these guys were going to get a look in, because people that
it's funny to see a band that sold nearly 100 million records was never going to get a look in.
It's weird though, that, isn't it? Because but look, it's happened to loads of bands over the years as well. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just because grunge was such a force.
Yeah.
You know, because think about it, like in 2001, the kind of grunge that was kicking about then was post-grunge, it was Puddle of Mud and Nickelback.
Yeah.
Those bands don't exist without grunge. It probably would be bands that would be like REM sounding, you know what I mean? Or something similar. So, yeah, I think that's what I meant back at the start when I said I think grunge did them dirty. I think there's a big part of their legacy, which is just kind of, it becomes quite hidden, you know?
I mean, allow me to completely sully the name of REM by bringing them into the same episode, but you can't convince me that Deep Blue Something would have been top of the charts for 10 weeks with Bricks at Tiffany's if REM hadn't been so big. I don't think those kind of bands would have been as successful, the Goo Goo Dolls and that kind of soft alternative.
The Goo Goo Dolls were kind of in the same realm as like a grunge band, as some of the post-grunge stuff.
They were earlier, and they were like soft alternative. So it's like, you've from REM and that period of breakthrough success, it kind of spawned this period of these acoustic-y things like Counting Crows. And I'm fucking perversely, actually, a couple of Counting Crows songs, I'm like, actually, just for nostalgia value, that's quite nice. But they're corny as shit. They're fucking horrible as a proposition overall. And this all led to like the Natalie and Brulia. I don't think, for example, Alanis Morissette would have been, the scene wouldn't have been set the same if it wasn't for bands like REM and that movement. I don't think Natalie and Brulia, I don't think Deep Blue Something. I mean, we spoke about the Rembrandts. The Rembrandts got the Friends gig because they didn't want to use Shiny Happy People in the end. Maybe it was a licensing fee or something like that. But like that, the Rembrandts are part of that sort of era of American like light alternative pop.
Yeah, I think that's a fair observation. But grunge just did something in that it united that people that liked alternative rock, people that liked heavy music, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the two kind of, it was like such a
shagged?
Yeah. It just had so much momentum that it really kind of blew apart any kind of connection that would have been there. Maybe bands like the ones you mentioned would have been more prominent to people who liked rock music, like me, if there just wasn't other things there that were heavier and more angry and angular.
Yeah, but I mean, Deep Blue Something were fucking number one for 10 weeks.
They were.
And I just do not think that would have happened in a world where Automatic for the People hadn't been the album that it was.
Yeah.
So I think the...
But the kids weren't going to listen to it though, you know?
Yeah, no, that's true, but I mean...
And that's ultimately at the end of the day what these people try to buy.
Yeah, but it influenced a lot about pop culture beyond the alternative. And that's what I think what Elizabeth Wurzel was saying. The alternative became the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
And in a weird way, stuff like Counting Crows and Natalie and Brulia were trying to feign being alternative, like Hootie and the fucking Blowfish, trying to be alternative. Fuck, even over here, the Lighthouse Family were almost like, is that an alternative band or is that a pop band? And that was the result of this blurring of the boundaries.
Yeah.
And REM, I do not believe for a minute have any actual culpability for that, but they became one of the biggest examples of it.
Mm. Another thing which kind of comes to mind is, without grunge, I guess pop punk doesn't happen, and a lot of alternative pop acts started to use the big slices of guitars that are quite prevalent in that music. You know, Avril Lavigne, like name any other female vaguely rockish artist.
Equally
in
without Alanis Morissette, Avril Lavigne probably doesn't become Avril Lavigne. And I don't think Alanis Morissette ends up doing what she did without a table that is set for grunge light kind of alternative indie mainstream music. So yeah, I mean, we can't disentangle this in any way. It's all interconnected.
It is. I just, like, I think, yeah, they just passed me by. So
do you fucking hate them? Like, that's what I'm getting at.
I hate parts of them, and I haven't listened to them so much, but I can stand back and appreciate some of the...
See, there's a good playlist in there.
The best of it is really good.
Right, that's
very listable, apart from a couple of songs which we've spoken about, like Shine Happy People, which can fuck off, and
yeah,
you know, all that kind of
and
stuff.
And do we agree they are not the Coldplay of 1992?
I would never have called him that in the first place, but...
fuck. Yeah. I'm just glad to prove to myself that they're not the Coldplay in 1982, I'll be honest. Okay, perfect. All right. Well, I mean, it's not a resounding victory, but it's a small victory, and that's enough.
I'm glad I listened to them. I like to. I like that my knowledge has been deepened.
We will do a playlist, and you will get a say in it. A small say in it. But what we'll also do is the Nexus.
A complicated series of connections between different things.
Yes. And so just as a recap for people that are not familiar with the Nexus, we, generally speaking, a listener nominates somebody, anybody, a character, a real person, a politician, a movie star, Garfield, who fucking cares, anybody, and then we have to try and link them like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon to the artist of the week. This week, Mark actually had nominated the person, and the person you nominated was...
Mary Shelley.
Mary Shelley.
Don't know why it came out of my head, but...
And so we have to link Mary Shelley to R.E.M. And because the album this week was my choice, I have to go first.
You do.
So this is the Nexus. R.E.M.'s Michael Stipe spoke out in praise of Greta Thunberg and Greta Thunberg's discussion of her autism diagnosis in 2019. I think he actually said that it brought him to tears. And Greta Thunberg chooses to refer to that autism diagnosis as Asperger's syndrome.
One of a variety of disorders which are on a spectrum of autism. There are people that would say that Asperger's doesn't exist because it's just on the spectrum of autistic.
Well... there's other people autism. That would say Asperger's doesn't exist because, oh, we don't want to talk about that. Because phrase has fallen out of favour since it is named after an Austrian doctor named Hans Asperger. He first used the term autistic psychosis in 1938, which was really, really early in the medical awareness of autism in general, or acknowledgement at least. And he did advance the knowledge on the subject greatly.
Just Nazis.
Yes, of course, it's me. Of course it's Nazis, right? So he advanced the knowledge in the subject greatly because, yeah, it was a massively neglected part of popular science. Going back centuries, it was like, oh, they're possessed. Oh, it's fucking like, you know, like even fairy stories, you know, Irish stories are like fairies stealing children and replacing them with like lookalikes, doppelgangers. Like Naomi Klein talks about that in the Doppelganger book as well, about how some of them, their children were autistic and they just imagined that their baby that was perfect had been stolen by the fairies and replaced by this baby that was dysfunctional. So Hans Asperger did a lot of actually really positive work in that field. However, he then went on to use that diagnosis, Asperger's diagnosis, to practice race hygiene under the Nazis, following them taking control in Vienna. And he rather enthusiastically, has to be said, helped send hundreds of children to institutions, knowing that there was no way out of those institutions. The only way out of those institutions was death. Those children were euthanized in those institutions as the Nazis sought to purify the bloodlines of conditions like that, as well as physical disabilities. As we know, hundreds of thousands of people lost their lives to that campaign. And Hans Asperger, unfortunately, played a really large part in that. So the fact that his name continues in that diagnosis is very, it sits very uneasily with a lot of people, and I can totally understand that.
Autistic spectrum disorders is what we're going to be called. So.
Also born in Austria and a member of the Nazi party was the notorious Joseph Blücher, the subject of a load of famous photos of that era, actually, including one of them during the suppression of the uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto that features him pointing this massive submachine gun at a young child that's surrendering. Blücher was well known to the Jews of the Warsaw Ghetto due to his brutality and his sexual violence in the ghetto, and they nicknamed him Frankenstein after the monster from Mary Shelley's book, which I must say, first of all, Frankenstein, as we know, was the doctor, not the monster, and is somewhat unfair because in the book the monster's monstrous acts are monstrous acts as a result of society rejecting him, and Joseph Blush's monstrous acts were a result of Joseph Blush being a piece of shit.
Yep, exactly. Frankenstein's monster is often misunderstood, isn't it, Cross?
Aye, aye. Over to you.
Mine's fairly short. Mary Shelley was a famous author.
What?
Wow. I really wanted to do a whole bunch about Percy.
Percy Blythe Shelley.
Percy Blythe Shelley. Because that guy was fucking wild.
She's also got like a bunch of semi-famous and sometimes illegitimate siblings as well.
Yeah.
Wollstonecraft.
Yeah. Because her mum was Mary Wollstonecraft. So yeah.
A wee bit, you know, her mum was a famous feminist and she liked her whole.
Yeah. So did Percy Blythe Shelley. So there was a film about Mary Shelley released in 2017, and she was played by Ellie Fanning.
Oh yeah.
One of her first roles was in The Door in the Floor, which is a family film starring Jeff Bridges and Kevin Bassinger. And turns out that Kevin Bassinger is from Athens, Georgia.
What?
Yeah. So my ex just gave me a shuddering halt when
that's
I found
amazing.
That out.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, fuck, okay, I guess. Because Ellie Fanning is from
she must be about the same age as R.E.M. as well.
No, she's 70.
What?
Yeah.
That's another what? Fucking
yeah.
Hell.
Ellie Fanning and Dakota Fanning are from a really small town in Georgia, but it's actually in the Atlanta region. It's not near Athens. So I was trying to make that connection and I just stumbled upon Kim Bassinger being from Athens.
Yeah,
but fun fact, get the Prince alarm ready. So after her first divorce, she briefly dated Prince. That was when Prince was doing the soundtrack for Batman, which of course she was in. She actually recorded an album with Prince.
That's mad.
Called Hollywood Affair, but it's never been released.
Are there samples anywhere?
I don't know.
Right, okay. That's
no idea.
Obviously, if this is complete silence now, I didn't find it.
But yeah, apparently it's never seen the light of day, so...
But if that wasn't complete silence...
That has seen the light of day.
It's great.
Yeah.
That's class. Well done. All right, cool. Okay, we're not actually sure what next week's going to be because we're fluctuating between a few possible episodes, so we'll get back to you on that. But we hope you've enjoyed this incredibly exhaustive dive into REM. And, well, I guess for a lot of you as well, the new format of the pod at the moment. If you don't like ads, Mark...
Patreon.com/unsungpod. £4 a month gets you to our Access All Areas Club.
Yeah. £15 a month gets you music sent straight to you, curated by us and bought from independent bands and artists around the world.
Yes.
So we would encourage you to give that some thought. But yeah, we will be back with another show very soon, as soon as we can coordinate interviews, back injuries, exploding appendix.
Appendices.
All right.
Take it easy. See you next week. Bye.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.